This is the Future of HR podcast, episode 144.
A lot of these mechanisms happen under our subconscious awareness. So taking a moment to pause and reflect is actually one of the most powerful things we can do. We don't talk enough in leadership development about awareness, attention, and discernment. I think those are three skills that can really help you be aware of where you are in time. Like, what is your inner state and how does it affect your outer state? And I really think about this like inside out leadership. Can I be clear on where I'm at? Where am I at in space and time and emotionally? And then how is that affecting the people around me? This can have a domino effect. If I'm a leader and I'm operating in the red zone, guess what's going to happen to the people that I'm interacting with on a daily basis, the people that report to me? But when I have a leader that's in the red all the time, it's not just about them. They're affecting everybody around them, and often very unintentionally so. And sometimes, quite frankly, that's the best they can do because of the state that they're in. The only way to create more capacity so that they can choose a different response is to start to practice some of these skills that we're talking about.
How can you find your green zone and stay grounded during times of stress? Why does leadership quality matter, especially during transformations? Hi, I'm your host, JP Elliott, and this is the Future of HR podcast, the only podcast whose mission is to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. On each episode, I interview successful HR executives and thought leaders who are reimagining, rethinking, and leading our field into the future. During our candid conversations, you will learn about their career journeys, their lessons learned along the way, and their insights on how to take our field, and most importantly, your career, to the next level. If you're really serious about becoming a more business-focused and strategic HR leader, then you need to make attending my Next Gen HR Accelerator program a part of your 2025 development plan. And if you're a CHRO who wants your HR team to have even more influence and business impact, then you're going to want to send your team to my Next Gen HR Accelerator program as well. Because my Next Gen HR Accelerator program is a best-in-class leadership development program specifically designed to equip high-potential HR talent with the skills, mindset, and tools they need to become strategic business leaders and value creators. Over four intensive weeks, you'll build your business acumen and financial acumen. You'll sharpen your strategic thinking, elevate your executive influence and communication skills, and learn how to translate business strategy to HR initiatives that deliver impact and value. You'll also get targeted feedback and coaching to help you grow as a leader. As every Next Gen HR Accelerator participant receives 360 feedback, personal coaching from me, and leaves with a targeted from-to development plan. That is why one past participant said the Next Gen HR Accelerator program completely transformed their approach to HR. Over the past year, over 100 HR leaders have been through the program from companies like Verizon, McDonald's, Nike, Prudential, Pacific Life, Hershey, Kohler, and many more. Our next cohort starts September 9th and registration is now open. Space is limited and we expect to sell out. To learn more about the Next Gen HR Accelerator program, go to futureofhr.com or reach out to me directly to learn more. And with that, I'm excited to introduce this week's guest, Diane Armstrong. Diane is a seasoned executive coach, transformation advisor, and talent management expert with 30 years of experience guiding leaders and organizations through complex change and growth. Prior to founding her own coaching business, Diane served as the SVP of Talent Management at Flex, a $35 billion global manufacturing company, and her earlier executive roles included time at McKesson, Neiman Marcus, and PepsiCo, where she led talent and organization effectiveness, drove large-scale transformations, and developed leaders at all levels. In her coaching and consulting practice, Diane helps leaders build their capability to successfully lead through business transformation, complexity, and change, and she helps leaders expand their strategic capabilities, influence, and presence in most senior levels. Diane also serves on the advisory board for the University of Texas McComb Center for Leadership and Ethics and teaches leadership courses at UT Exec MBA program. What I appreciate about Diane is her coaching style is direct, science-based, and results-oriented. I know you're going to learn a lot in this conversation. We discussed why leadership gaps matter and how overlooking poor leadership can cost organizations dearly, why leadership development can be a significant driver of business transformation, what green zone leadership is and how leaders can stay grounded during times of organizational chaos, how chronic stress affects the brain, decision-making, and leadership behavior, and what leaders can do about it, and the practical strategies HR leaders and executives can take to shift out of the red zone and into their green zone, and much, much more. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode as you listen, so drop me a line on LinkedIn or say hello. And now let's jump into my conversation with Diane. Diane, welcome to the Future of HR podcast. How are you?
I'm good, JP. Great to be here.
We've been friends for a long time, and so it's great to have you on the podcast. You have been an executive leading talent or org development at some amazing firms, Pepsi, Neiman Marcus, McKesson, and Flex. And I'm curious, as you think about these experiences, what did they teach you about developing leaders at scale?
I spent my formative years, like you said, at Accenture and PepsiCo. So that's about 19 years if I were to add it up. What that really did for me is it put me in front of very senior leaders very early in my career, which happens in consulting when you're doing these big transformation projects and you're doing really important, significant shifts for companies. You spend a lot of time with senior leaders. And so I saw over years at Accenture, a lot of different types of leaders across a lot of different types of companies, a lot of different types of industries. And it became really clear that the difference between a really great leader and the difference between not so great leader had a big impact on our outcomes on these transformations. I learned very early in that there is a real gap in leadership and that gap is meaningful. So a few things that I took away from my years doing both leadership development and working with different types of leaders, supporting different types of leaders. The first one is to really be aware that those leadership gaps matter. I think sometimes we can sweep under the rug the realization that a leader who is not so great at leading other people but gets great business results is someone we actually need to address. And we need to look at that and decide, is this really the right person for our organization? Do we have them in the right role? Do we need to do something differently there? So I think being really clear the cost of these leadership gaps in your organization is a very real cost. Secondly, belief that leadership matters is really important. And sending that message from the top down and expecting leaders to participate in developing other leaders, to participate in leadership development programs, to actually ask leaders to be measured on their leadership capability. One of our big debates at PepsiCo, and something that they do incredibly well at PepsiCo, is develop leaders. It's a bit of a religion over there, is how do we weigh business results versus leadership capability and people skills? And we ended up with a 50-50 rating, which I felt like was a tremendous vote for how important this is in the organization. You have to make these kinds of decisions as a leadership team, as an organization, as a culture. What are we going to ask of our leaders? That is a really important decision to make. And by the way, there has to be teeth to it. So I can't just say, yes, I want everyone to be a great leader. You have to actually hold them accountable, and there should be consequences and measurements. And I should have a sense of, are these leaders really demonstrating the behaviors, the EQ, the people skills that we need to make sure that our people are succeeding, they want to work here, we've created a great place to work, and they're frankly building the capability and demonstrating these really important leadership skills that we need them to demonstrate in order to get the business outcomes that we're looking for. So that accountability piece is really important. Also want to emphasize leadership at every level, because what I often will see, and I help companies with this now, but I also experience this throughout different time running talent management organizations, is they'd come in and say, well, we just want to develop VPs, or we just want to develop first line leaders. First thing I have to say about that is if the first time people receive leadership development is as an executive, that's a problem. Because now you're teaching people who've been managing people for quite a while basic skills they should have learned as a first time manager. How do you delegate? How do you manage and rearrange your time? How do you make sure to focus on what matters most and not create a million things for the team to work on? How do you set clear goals? How do you evaluate performance? These are blocking and tackling skills that if you are getting your first information about how to do that well as an executive or a more senior leader, that's bad news. So levels of leadership development, I think, are another really important part of this. And the last thing I will say, we could probably talk about this for the entire podcast, but the last thing I will say about this is measurement matters. So setting the right goals at the beginning for whatever leadership development you're doing, measuring throughout, not just from the people that are in the program, but also people who are the recipients of the outcomes of that program, all of the stakeholders, the managers and the leaders, the people who are actually paying for the program, and then continuing to consider and evaluate that investment over time. Those are some really important things about leading at scale.
Yeah, what I hear you saying there is really how to take the leadership development and developing leaders seriously. Yeah, it's got to be intentional. You've got to have mindset. You've got to think about the pipeline and not just the top of the house. And you've got to have some way to measure that and make sense. And I think that's really, those are all great lessons. And you've had some good experiences at really academy companies doing this. Not everyone has that same experience. But recently you made the decision to go out on your own executive coaching and consulting business, really helping leaders to scale, helping organizations to scale their leaders. Let's talk more about that. You've got an opportunity to help lots of different people, not just one company, but why was this the right time for you? And what advice might you have for someone who's thinking about following your footsteps?
When I started doing leadership development at Accenture and PepsiCo, I did a lot of leadership development programs, competency models, and helping develop leaders. But it was really when I started to learn more about assessment and getting certified in assessments and in coaching processes and practices that I really got the one-on-one experience of working with a leader more intimately. And I just really loved that. I felt like the practice of helping bring self-awareness to a leader, which I think is a really powerful part of the learning and development process for leadership, and helping them just have those insights, those moments of aha to reflect on why they do what they do, not just what they do. And as they're trying to address gaps or issues, to me, that connection to the bottom line and really getting to see if the leader shifts behavior in this way, or they take on this new habit or pattern, how does that actually affect their business? And when I could see that connection, I was pretty hooked. I thought that was really amazing. So I really loved that work. And although obviously I kept working in talent management on kind of broader talent processes and strategies and organization design, I really never lost that love for working one-on-one or in small groups with leaders to help them through that process. And it allowed me a way to bring together a lot of things I was learning about. I'm a high input person. I take training all the time. I'm reading all the time. I take in a lot of information. When neuroscience first started getting into the business space and neuroleadership, I went through actually a bit of a health journey where I learned a lot about somatic therapy and somatic principles. And I started pulling all of these together in leadership development, in change management training, in one-on-one conversations with leaders. And so it allowed me to bring together a lot of things, even outside our own leadership development practices and principles and the science of psychometrics and all of those inputs. Bringing all that together was really meaningful for me. I really decided as I continued to progress in my talent management career that at some point I wanted to go out and do this full-time on my own. So after being with, I think I led talent at Neiman Marcus, and then I was in transformation at McKesson, and then I led talent at Flex. I decided it would make sense at that point to head out on my own. A part of that decision was needing some personal flexibility as well. Like a lot of people that I'm sure that listen to you, I had both personal demands. In my case, it was elder care needs and issues that came up. So I needed more flexibility to deal with that. The sandwich generation is real. I'm here to attest. And so just some decisions, that was part of the decision process as well. But pulling all of that together to launch a business has been a lot of fun. I've really enjoyed it. And now I can focus full time on coaching and leadership development, which is probably my greatest passion. My advice for someone who wants to do this on their own. So the first thing is, I feel like my process of receiving certifications and practicing with those certifications for assessments and for coaching. And I did a lot of coaching. I've been coaching for 15 years at this point. And I think building that expertise in-house was really helpful for when I went on my own, because I was able to say, hey, I've actually been doing this a really long time and have all this experience with Hogan assessments and leadership team assessments and all of these other pieces. So I think that's one thing, is start building your skill set, start building your tool set early on, if this is something that you think you could be interested in. And then the second thing is networking. I was very lucky to work with just absolutely amazing people throughout my career. And I reach out to them on a regular basis, and they partner with me and they bring me into things and into problems that they're having with their companies. So that network is really critical. The one advice I would give, because we get so busy, and I didn't always do this, so I really feel like this is something I would have done differently if I could have gone back in time. That would be nice, wouldn't it, to have a time machine that could go back and change a few things. I just didn't always keep in touch with people that I worked with. We were just busy. They're busy. I'm busy. It was nothing personal, but I probably would have spent more time doing that proactively and finding a way to do that. That's the only thing I would offer, is just keep your network really strong as you move into thinking about going out on your own.
Great advice. Yeah. And you've been really successful doing that. But like you said, you've been coaching for 15 years. You've been building up a lot of relationships. And I think that is a really strong foundation when you want to scale and have an impact outside of one organization, or more flexibility in your case, a little more flexibility to handle life's demands. Now, Diane, you also are working on something that is pretty new to me. I'm going to just be honest with the podcast here. Finding your green zone is something you talk about. This idea of this green zone leadership, which is a way for leaders to stay grounded in chaos, which makes a lot of sense. But can you paint a picture for us, to our listeners, what this actually looks like when a leader's operating from their green zone versus, I'm not sure what other color zone there is.
Red. Let's call it a red zone.
Fine. Red zone.
Let me start by explaining why this even matters. I deal with a lot of leaders every day, and have for many, many years, as we've talked about, where we're under such significant pressure. Like, you and I have both had the experience of sitting in the seat, where every single day there's all these demands on you. You feel like the water is rising, and people get to this state of resigned overwhelm. And they're operating day to day, just trying to survive, basically. It's a survival mode that we get into. And this is where you see a lot of coping behaviors come in. You see a lot of numbing behaviors come in. People may not be aware at the level of chronic stress that they're operating with. But if you start asking the questions like, what are you doing to numb? Or what are you doing to cope? Then you start getting a really interesting conversation. People just, especially, I would say, in the last couple of years to 3 years, even Pat, from COVID on, I have just seen this escalate and escalate and escalate. It's not like we haven't had chronic stress for a really long time for executives. But when you talk to executives, you can just feel this sense of, oh, there's so much that is needed from me, that my team needs from you, the organization needs from me. Oh, and by the way, here's a transformation to run. And here's this other really huge thing we need to do. And can you take on the next job up? And you can look and see the person sitting in that job and you think, oh my gosh, I am not sure I can take on that next thing. Can I take on one more thing? I think this is a very real experience. I've seen it in a lot of leaders that I work with. And when I talk to other coaches, when I talk to other HR professionals, they see it as well. And they're frankly experiencing it. So that's the problem that's on the table. What do we see when someone is in, let's call it the red zone? So I talk about the green zone, but I want to go to the red zone first, because I think people will relate to this. So what's happening is we're in a point of reactivity. I have less capacity. I call it capacity. I have less capacity to choose my response, to be thoughtful, to be strategic, to use all those fantastic critical thinking skills that we get in our prefrontal cortex, because it basically starts to shut down on us because we are in a fight, flight, or freeze mode. Now, it's pretty natural to go in and out of a fight, flight, or freeze mode. If you talked about somatic principles, they talk about this window of tolerance. Whereas this space we want to be, it's kind of like a green zone where I can react, I can get stressed, I can go out of that window of tolerance, but I can come back in. So let's say a car pulls out in front of me on the highway. Well, in that moment, I'm going to be pretty stressed. I'm going to be trying to manage the situation. And hopefully, though, by the time I get to work, nothing happened, I'm able to calm back down, bring my nervous system back down to a normal place, and I can move on with my day. But what we find in people that are stuck in their red zone, which happens a lot, actually, they don't have that same capacity. They don't have as much flexibility, as much adaptability. They're not as open. You can almost think of it as a difference between expansiveness and contraction. So if you think about when someone is in a state of fear, in a state of defensiveness, they're way less likely to reach out to others, to be collaborative, to take risks, to take an opportunity to learn something new, to innovate and be creative. Like all those great things that frankly we need leaders doing on an everyday basis get contracted. So that's what the red zone looks like. I get reactive. I don't have as much opportunity to choose how I'm going to respond in any particular situation. And then, by the way, it starts linking to health issues and it starts linking to bad habits and things that we know we should do, but we don't. So there's a lot that we can lose when we operate in that red zone a lot. So let's shift to talking about the green zone.
Yeah, the red zone is bad. We don't want to be in the red zone, but I do think you're right. When you talk about being grounded in chaos, I mean, the world feels more chaotic, more pressure. We feel like we all have less time and we're probably being asked to do more than we ever have. So I totally get that a lot of us can operate in the red zone, even without knowing it. To your point, like how do we start to identify that we're in the red zone so we can get maybe take control back a little bit to get to the green zone?
Yeah, it's a great question. I know as Simon Sinek brought this up, as some therapists use this as well, this idea of how did I respond to the environment around me? This idea of trigger, notice people getting triggered. I get triggered if I have an emotional response that's a 5 or greater on a scale of 1 to 10 on something that happens to me that's probably disproportionate to what happened to me. So it gives me a sense that I'm reacting without much choice in that reaction. And my reaction is disproportionate to the situation. When I start to notice that, that can look like anger, that can look like upset, that can look like anxiety. And my reaction can differ because personalities differ under stress. Paying attention and that awareness that has to come in, I'm a big fan of observe what's happening with you, what's happening in your body, what's happening with your emotions, what's happening with the way you interact with other people. Like we've all had the experience, we have a really bad day at work, we come home, we take it on the family, that reactivity, right? Or someone comes in and they're like, I need you to bake a dozen cupcakes for tomorrow, for which you're like, you have to be kidding me. All of that is that if you're in the best version of yourself, you'd been take a deep breath. It's going to be okay. We'll figure the cupcakes out. You're in the worst version of yourself. You're going to react immediately. This is a great example of how I can tell. I can test and say, where am I? Am I in the green zone? Am I in the red zone? Or somewhere in between? The other thing I want to bring up here, yes, it is subconscious. You're bringing up a really important point. A lot of these mechanisms happen under our subconscious awareness. So taking a moment to pause and reflect is actually one of the most powerful things we can do. I talk about awareness and I talk about attention. So where am I focusing my attention at any point in time? And I talk about discernment. So discernment is really important because it helps us think through, why am I reacting the way I am? Is the situation calling for this behavior or is the situation actually calling for something different? Is the thing that has happened really requiring the level of reaction that it's getting from me? Do I need to be trying something different? We don't talk enough in leadership development about awareness, attention, and discernment. I think those are three skills that can really help you be aware of where you are in time. Like, what is your inner state and how does it affect your outer state? And I really think about this like inside out leadership. Can I be clear on where I'm at? Where am I at in space and time and emotionally? And then how is that affecting the people around me? This can have a domino effect. If I'm a leader and I'm operating in the red zone, guess what's going to happen to the people that I'm interacting with on a daily basis, the people that report to me? We talk about behavioral contagion and we talk about priming in neuroscience and in psychology. All the things happen when I have a leader that's in the red all the time. It's not just about them. They're affecting everybody around them and often very unintentionally so. And sometimes, quite frankly, that's the best they can do because of the state that they're in. The only way to create more capacity so that they can choose a different response is to start to practice some of these skills that we're talking about. Awareness, what am I spending my time and attention on? Am I discerning what I need to be believing about my current situation, my mindset, the decisions that I need to make that are in front of me that I might do differently if I could bring myself to a better state of being internally?
Yeah. And I'm really curious about the neuroscience piece as you talked about that. So what's happening in our brains when we're under this constant pressure or stress, and how's that starting to show up in the leadership behaviors like you described? But is there ways for us to now reprogram ourselves and say, hey, wait a minute, using neuroscience to be a better leader and get out of that red zone and get to the green zone.
Yeah, absolutely. I got really into the neuroscience of leadership and change management and learning. So there's a lot of fields in the HR space that can really benefit from a better understanding of neuroscience and the way our brains work. And by the way, it's not just the neural structure, it's also the nervous system and it's also neurochemicals. So all of those things work together to dramatically impact our behavior, believe it or not. And all of it's happening subconsciously, which is kind of unfortunate. It'd be nice if we had some kind of dashboard that would be like, you're in fight or flight. Your nervous system is going into dysregulation. But unfortunately, that's not what happens. We just start behaving in ways that make other people crazy or ourselves crazy. The way I put it is we create misery for ourselves and others. So the brain science of this is actually really interesting and powerful. The primary thing to be aware of is our brain can wire for threat or it can wire for reward. And the more we stay in chronic stress, the more wired we are for threat, meaning we scan our environment constantly looking for threats. We look for errors in the environment. We look for something that might be a trigger for us. By the way, our brain does this literally all the time, constantly. It's amazing how our brain works. But if we're in survival mode, we see most of that as a threat opportunity. We get defensive and we have a lot of defensive mechanisms that kicks in for us. Then our amygdala, where we often process a lot of this, is in charge. So we get flooded with those neurochemicals for stress, for fight, flight, or freeze, and we lose access to our prefrontal cortex. So we're just going to just a little bit of science here for a moment. The prefrontal cortex is where all the good stuff happens, right? If we can get as much oxygen and energy, which is in the form of sucrose, to the prefrontal cortex, we have much better cognitive capabilities. Remember me talking about expansion versus contraction? That's where all those expansion skills and capabilities come in. I'm better at making decisions. I'm better at solving problems. I'm better at creativity. I'm better at taking great educated risks, collaborating with others, trusting others. And then again, when you bring in neurochemicals, that brings even more great behavior to the table. Like I'm willing to bond with other people. I'm willing to listen to other people. I'm capable of learning. So all of these really, really important behaviors are tied to the neuroscience of this. So if I can get that oxygen and glucose to my prefrontal cortex, then I'm going to be able to do that better. If I'm in fight or flight mode, if I'm in protective or threat mode, what happens is all of that glucose and oxygen goes somewhere else. It goes to my body, so that I can run, I can do whatever I need to do to protect myself, because I think the tiger just jumped out of the woods. But tigers are rarely jumping out of the woods during our day at work. We just think they are, and we subconsciously operate as if that's what's happening. And unfortunately for a lot of us, that wiring is pretty permanent. Like we're in that threat zone all day long, and our body starts to lead before our brain catches up. When our nervous system picks up those signals of danger, before we're even aware of it, we automatically goes into these kind of shutdown or defensive modes. And we just don't have as much capacity to do the really important things we need to do as a leader. So that's a little bit of the neuroscience behind it.
Yeah, it's really helpful. And this podcast, you are eligible for one class in biology. So thank you for joining.
You get your CEUs and an email.
If you stay through the end, yes, we'll tell you where you can get your certification. I think neuroscience has a really good place. And I think there's a lot going on that we should understand about that. So I appreciate you kind of laying that out, because it is a little more complex than just fight or flight. We like to make things simple and categorize it, and that's helpful, but real life is a little more complex. So getting practical for a moment, Diane, if an HR leader is listening and thinking, I'm definitely not in the green zone right now, what's one thing they can do to help get out of that red zone and get more centered?
I would say start small. So I think we have this impression that, oh, I need to meditate for an hour every day. We would definitely all benefit from meditating for an hour per day. I still haven't achieved that, and I've been doing this a long time. When I work with leaders on how do I spend more time in the green zone, I start with really simple, basic things. First of all, breath. I had a great mindfulness coach that taught me that a single breath is a meditation. Like breathing in and breathing out, slowing your breathing. If you can make your exhale longer than your inhale, you get extra points, because it will automatically send a signal to start regulating your nervous system. But very simple things. What are the things that you can use to relax yourself? Get up and take a walk. Don't ruminate, while you're walking. So trying to really pay attention to what are your five senses noticing as you take a walk. You could put your hand on your chest. What does your hand feel like if you're breathing in and out? There's another great one I learned from a somatic therapist that's super easy. You could do at your desk, get out a piece of paper, put a pen in one hand and a pen in the other hand, and draw something with both hands at the same time. So this utilizes both sides of your brain, and it also is a bit of a mindfulness exercise. I draw trees because I have terrible drawing capability, but you can draw whatever you want, little house tree. You'll start to feel your nervous system just start to calm down, especially when you know you're going into high stakes and really stressful situation. This could be, these little things can make a big difference. I work a lot with leaders on this, and we do a lot of things in the way that we think about our work and we think about our world that can actually activate and push it to the red zone, like ruminating, catastrophizing, or that inner critic will come in and start harassing you. So just having some observation and awareness under what circumstances am I starting to get in my red zone, and then just little micro things you can do to help you create a little bit of regulation in your system.
Yeah, I think it's really helpful because we don't always talk about this a little bit. It's part of mental health. It's a part of just well-being. It's a part of dealing with the stress that we all have today and the way we operate in this world. Really good tips. So hopefully people can find more of their green zone. Reach out to you to find out more about this if they want. Also want to talk a little more about switching gears a little bit, but you are and have spent a lot of time developing leaders that are transforming organizations, done a lot of transformation work in your career. And you've said that leadership development is one of the highest leverage ways to transform business performance. Talk to us a little bit more about why you believe this and what's that connection.
I've mentioned my formative years at Accenture and PepsiCo. They really set my initial beliefs around this because I could see both of those companies invested very heavily in leadership and talent development and believe strongly that your number one competitive differentiator is the quality of your people and the quality of your leaders. I have not seen a single thing in my over 30 years of doing this that would contradict that belief. I have only seen evidence that that is true. I've been really excited as I work with leaders in development programs and in coaching, that as I help leaders observe what they want to change and make changes in significant ways, we do see that it changes organizations and it changes what companies are capable of. Understanding how leaders shape culture, strategy, and execution is a really important piece of the puzzle here, because the biggest barrier to business transformation and, quite frankly, leader performance is not usually technology or we didn't do the process right or we haven't innovated. Obviously, those things are important. But consistently having a leadership gap in the organization, especially at the higher levels of your organization, is going to be a really significant problem for achieving your strategy. I've seen that as a trend over and over and over again. And you mentioned transformation. I've been involved with leading transformations and supporting transformations through all the decades that I've been doing this. It's something that is an area of expertise for me. We will often take a person who has great functional and technical knowledge and we'll put them in charge of a transformation for an organization without a lot of consideration about what is this person's capability to bring people together, to drive change, to inspire and motivate, to influence others, to communicate. When we bring someone who has limited leadership capability and we give them these huge responsibilities, we're really creating a potential opportunity for ourselves, a real problem down the road. I saw that so many times in the work that I did over the years in consulting and at the companies that I worked with. So I've grown a really strong point of view about how important leadership is for success in not just transformation, but in business performance overall. And by the way, the research backs this up. You and I both know years, decades really, of leadership research about how important these skills are and that companies that consistently invest in leadership, set expectations, and we talked about holding people accountable, they see different results than their competitors. And I think this is true for individual leaders as well. If we've all had the experience of working for great leaders and terrible leaders, we know the difference that that leadership capability can make. And so then when you multiply that by all the leaders in organization, it makes a big difference in terms of what the company is able to achieve.
Yeah, I think your point around just building leadership development as a business driver, really thinking about that across the whole organization, can be so powerful. And I think a lot of organizations don't do this because we're thinking short term, we're thinking quarter to quarter, we're not thinking decades and years and thinking the pipeline. And organizations that have done this, those few academy companies, some that you've worked with, have taken a much longer point of view on it. But some organizations, they are really kind of struggling with their leadership development programs because maybe they are more generic and they're not as aligned to the business needs, or maybe they're not getting the value or not being seen as a value driver because they are generic. How would you approach that, Diane? And how do you recommend people really try to align that, align their leadership development with their business needs?
I believe that every time we sit down to solve any problem from an HR perspective, or rather what usually happens, we decide we're going to present a solution. So whether it's a talent process or whether it's a leadership program, whatever we are bringing to the table, we have to start with the business. You talk about this so much in the work that you do, and I couldn't be more passionate about it. Probably because of my consulting experience, the way that you be an effective consultant, which I think everybody in HR is a consultant, is you get into the business and you deeply understand the problems that are keeping them up at night. And I believe that the most powerful HR and the most powerful leadership development is designed to help business solve the most painful problems that they have. The differentiator that your competitors cannot copy is your talent. Now, they can poach it, so you want to create a great place for them to work so that they'll stay, but it's hard for them to create a copy of your talent and a copy of your leadership capability. And those companies, as we mentioned, that invest in developing leadership capability at multiple levels of leadership will find that to be a differentiating capability over time that doesn't go away. As a leader developing leadership development programs in HR, I want to tap into that business need. From the very beginning, say, what are the objectives that I want to meet with this program, and have leaders be involved in defining that. So I really believe stakeholder management is an important part of successful leadership development. Getting leaders to weigh in on what do they think the most significant leadership gaps and opportunities are? What do they need leaders to be really good at that they're not good at today? And then designing programs that help them do that. And of course, you're going to bring your own wisdom to the table. So it's not just what the business needs, but it also is your own expertise. I mean, hopefully as in HR, we're keeping up to date with the latest research, the latest data, the latest tools and technologies that are available so that we can bring that to the business in a consultative way and say, hey, here's what other companies are doing. Here's some things that are really working. Here's some things that if we could teach our leaders how to do this, it would make a big difference in their outcome. So you have that piece of the puzzle as well. But those things should come together then to develop a program that's going to deliver outcomes. And I really believe that, I know it's hard and we've been struggling with this for decades, but measuring the outcomes of these programs to the degree that we can is really important. This can be easier with like a sales organization or a customer service organization where they've got a lot of metrics that you can watch and see how it gets impacted. But we can even do it around behaviors. If we talk to leaders and say, look, if I could get your senior director leaders or VP leaders to be better at defining strategies, and we could actually measure their ability to do that, would you be willing to sign up for that and buy a development program that would help them do that? Not too many senior executives are going to say no to that. It's really putting forth a measurable outcome from the beginning and measuring it in the middle and measuring at the end, and not just talking with the people in the development program, but also with the people that they're reporting to and the people that are going to be the beneficiaries of these new behaviors and skills that you're developing. I think all of that makes it a much more, it's a tailored program that's going to deliver more value directly to the business. And quite frankly, that's how you get more money to these programs. A little bit of a tip for talent managers and HR leaders out there who are like, I can't get any budget. I cannot get, you know, they keep cutting my budget. This is absolutely a recipe for success. Sit down with the leaders and ask them, what are their most painful problems? How can you help them to fix them? Just like we talked about, bring in solutions that will help them do that and measure the effect. I did a leadership development programs at Neiman Marcus for the stores, which was obviously their big sales organization. When we worked with those leaders, we could actually see the impact to their metrics in the stores. They had their revenue increased, their customer service scores increased. I was able to then take that information and bring it back and say, hey, if we roll this out, I'm a big fan of pilots and trying things and seeing what works and what doesn't. If we can roll this out, of course, they were ready to sign up for that and give us all kinds of budget for it. A lot of this is the language that you're doing and having that business connection that you're talking about.
Yeah, it's a great example. And so important to start with what business problem we're solving and how we align that back to leadership development programs versus just saying we're building leaders. But hey, we're actually building leaders that solve these business problems, I think is the right way to think about that. It's brilliant. Diane, last question for you. What is one word or phrase that you believe will define the future of HR over the next 5 to 10 years?
I thought about this a lot, like all of your podcast guests do. And for me, it's be bold. We are in some really challenging times right now. We've talked about leading in chaos. I think HR is leading in massive amounts of chaos. And being bold is what is needed from HR right now. We have a really important voice at the table. There are a lot of things that need to change and be done differently in our companies and organizations over the next 5 years. And so I think HR is in exactly the right spot to be that voice and to have a point of view and to make it happen.
I love it. Diane, thank you for being bold and getting us into the green zone. It was a great conversation. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks, JP. It was so great to be here.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Future of HR Podcast. Thanks again to Diane for helping us to find our green zone and lead well, even in times of chaos. As always, you can go to futureofhr.com to view all of our past episodes and learn more about our mission to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. And if you've been enjoying the Future of HR podcast, then I think you'll enjoy my Future of HR newsletter, which is the only newsletter that's focused on helping HR leaders to elevate their career and business impact. Each week, you'll get actionable and practical ideas on how you can be an even more business-focused and even more strategic HR leader. To subscribe, go to futureofhr.com and be sure to download my HR Leaders Blueprint, which is 18 pages of real-world advice from 100-plus HR leaders with simple, actionable, and proven strategies to advance your career. We'll be back next week with Anita Graham, CHRO of LabCorp. Anita is a business-focused leader and CHRO, and in our conversation, we dig into what makes an HR team high-performing and how to build a people strategy that drives business results. This is a great conversation and one you will not want to miss. Thanks again for listening to the Future of HR and being part of our community.